Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Ed Grange. Ed remembers when Holy Cross Electric Association brought power to Basalt and the surrounding ranchland. It was September of 1941. Ed was a freshman in high school, and he and his older brother went to town that Saturday for the celebration. Refrigerators and freezers lined the street, and he remembers raiding the freezers for ice cube fights with his friends on Main Street. The celebration that day was short-lived. 2 months later, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and plans for rural electrification were put on hold, and resources were sent east for the war effort. But Ed never forgot that day in Basalt. He'd grown up on a farm outside of town and watched his Italian immigrant parents struggle to make the ranch successful. He knew that electricity would revolutionize their lives. 9 years later, in 1950, Ed was home from college for the summer and took a part-time job with Holy Cross Electric, the company that had just brought power to his parents' ranch. Little did he know then that that part-time job would grow into a full-time job and last for 60 years. Ed retired in 2011 as the CEO of Holy Cross Energy. Here he remembers growing up on the ranch before electricity.
It was interesting. We had carbide lights. Hardly anybody had carbide lights. They were a big improvement on coal oil lanterns, which everybody depended upon. Most kids, you know, studied at night by coal oil lamps or Coleman lanterns, which were a little bit better. My mother had a little gas burner, and she had irons that she could hook up, but she never did that. She always heated the irons on the stove, but at least we did have lights, and they were bright. So my dad really said, you know, we're getting along okay. And it was till I graduated in college that they finally decided that maybe they should do this, and they got on the list, and I think in November of 1949, got power to the ranch for the first time. And it was a special time for me because my mother finally then had the privilege or the fortune of having a refrigerator. And before that, you know, all the farmers back in the early days, they just had to process food or can it or whatever. And she finally was able to have a refrigerator and a deep freeze. And I think one of the biggest things was a washing machine. We had a washing machine that was run by a gasoline engine. And of course, it was out on the front porch. It was really loud. And in the wintertime, to keep it from freezing, you had to bring it into the kitchen and run the exhaust outside. So, you know, life was tough in those days without electricity. And I guess, you know, in my lifetime, being associated with Holy Cross, the greatest thing was seeing people being so appreciative of having their lives changed, because before Holy Cross came, they had no way to preserve food, they had no way to pump water, they had hand pumps for wells, and to see the change when electricity was available and they were able to buy electric motors, refrigerators, deep freezes, ranges, and all that sort of thing. You know, I think the biggest impact was on the women, for sure, because the men, of course, were inconvenienced, but they had gasoline engines that they used for different things like grinding feed. But the women were really at a disadvantage, because how were they going to keep food from spoiling? You know, all of them had root cellars. They could put fruits and vegetables there, but, you know, they wouldn't keep very long. Produce had to be canned. They had to depend on their gardens for most all of their food. I can remember that when I was very young, that they would take eggs to the local store in Basalt. There were two grocery stores, and they would trade eggs for groceries, and they'd do the same thing My mother would pick raspberries. When she had a crate of 24 pints, she'd take those over to the Hubbard grocery store in Basalt and trade for groceries. And we always had credit there. So that's how everything was done in the early days. It was usually didn't go to town except maybe once a week to the post office and to get groceries.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. My interview today is with Ed Grange. Ed is the retired CEO of Holy Cross Energy, and he grew up on a farm near Basalt without electricity, so he takes great pride in his role in helping bring power to the Roaring Fork and the Gore Valley. There are many stories in Ed's 60-year career with Holy Cross, but one that stands out is the role the electric company played in helping Peter Seibert realize his dream of a world-class ski resort.
Yeah, really, to get the complete story, and you might not want it all because I got a lot of memories and what memory bank I got left, but you really have to go back to 1939 when Holy Cross was started. You know, you sort of wonder why, with all our headquarters in Glenwood, how we ever got into the Gore Valley. But there were two groups of farmers in 1939. There was a group that lived in the area from Walcott to Minnern. It's another group of farmers that lived up the Colorado River in Burns and that area up there, State Bridge. And they got together and they applied to the REA in Washington for a loan to build power lines because they didn't have electricity. Well, at the same time that they were doing this in 39, there was another group of farmers located in the Roaring Fork Valley, starting from the side of Aspen, going down to Carbondale. And they were also meeting in Basalt, and they were trying to get a group together to file for a loan from REA in Washington. Well, REA said, well, neither one of your two groups are big enough to justify building, giving you a loan to build power lines. So why don't you get together and maybe with a joint effort, we can make the thing feasible so we can give you a loan. So they decided to get together and form one co-op. So Holy Cross really in the beginning in 39 was formed by the two groups, the one from Minnern down to Wolcott and the other one from Aspen to Carbondale. And I think one of the county agents, I think in Eagle County, is the one that picked the name of Holy Cross because of the proximity of the mountain that everybody was familiar with, and they thought that would be a good name for this new little co-op. Let's see, the power was turned on in 1941, and of course, as we've known, there was a big celebration in Basalt, but we were kind of isolated from the people in the Eagle Valley, but it was still a way that they did get power. I can remember the stories that were told when the office was in Basalt, and somebody would call from some ranch or someplace between Minturn and Wolcott and say their power was off. Well, then, in the very early days, they just lock up the office in Basalt, and George would take off. You know, even being the manager, he was the chief lineman. So they'd lock up the office, and they'd get in the truck and go up to Minturn or Lake Creek or wherever they had to. You can imagine how long people would be out of power by the time they got from Basalt to Wolcott. But people didn't complain in those days.
That was George Thurston, right? He was...
George Thurston was the general manager. They called him line superintendent at that time.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. And my interview today is with Ed Grange. Ed has just been describing how Western Colorado farmers and ranchers founded Holy Cross Electric Association in 1939 and brought power to rural farmers and ranchers in the Roaring Fork and Gore Valleys. Today, the Gore Valley is often referred to as the Vail Valley, but in the 50s, it was Mountain Meadows and a few sheep ranchers.
Probably 1956, 57, there were two Greek sheepmen who had large herds of sheep. They were headquartered in Utah, but in the summertime they had permits to run sheep in the Gore Valley. Of course, that would have been an ideal place for sheep in the summertime. And they had ranch houses in the upper end of the Gore Valley, and they pestered us for years about building them a line. And in those days, of course, Holy Cross was really organized on the basis that everybody had to sign a membership application, and that's how things became feasible. We had enough customers that it made it feasible to bring them electricity. Well, these two Greek sheepmen, and their name was Katsis and Katipas, and they kept coming in and said, well, you know, we really would like to have power up there, and we kept putting them off. But in 1958, we finally agreed that we'd throw that construction in with some other that we were doing. So we said, okay, you've got to pay $5 a month on an annual basis, so that's going to be $60 a year. And they finally agreed, yeah, they could do that. So we built a line up there for those three customers at the upper Gore Valley. So they had electricity by the end of 1958. It was just a single-phase line that we had extended from the end of the line that we had built back in 1941, because there really wasn't anything else up there except the ranches. And it was shortly after that that we noticed that applications were coming in for some people in Denver that had bought some of the ranches, and they wanted the accounts transferred over to their name. And, you know, this went on for a few months, and I started wondering, you know, why are these people from Denver coming over to the Gore Valley? I mean, that's a long ways from Denver, and these seemed to be pretty influential people. I think it sounded like they had money. So looked into that, and it turned out that these accounts were being put in the name of Transmontane Rod and Gun Club. That really got my curiosity going, why they were buying ranches for a rod and gun club. So I don't know, I called somebody, and they said, oh yeah, these are a club in Denver that got some fairly affluent people in there, and they just want to come over here and be able to hunt and fish on private land. Well, that sort of made sense, I guess. I never would have thought, you know, that they would be buying ranches to do this. But in today's world, you know, you can understand how that would happen. But back in the late 50s, people weren't buying ranches just to have places to hunt. There was places all over the Western Slope to hunt. Well, it turned out that the Transmontane Rod and Gun Club was just a cover-up for what was really the dream of Pete Seibert and Earl Eaton, who had picked out Vail for a place to build a really exclusive, well, maybe not exclusive, but a real great ski area. And what they were doing, they were getting investors, and they knew that if they said they were going to build a ski area, that the prices probably would escalate greatly. So nobody wanted them to know what they were doing. So over a period of a couple of years, they acquired practically all of the land from the bottom of Vail Pass down to where Vail exists now. Some of them were a little hard to get because some of the ranchers didn't want to sell, but they were persistent and they were able to get everything. And then when they were ready to go to start developing the ski area, then of course the word came out, you know, our real purpose here is to build a ski area, and we now have the land that we need to do that. We got the land where we want to put the village, so be it. that was coming. And I think they picked up all those ranches probably for a pretty reasonable price, I'll bet.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Ed Grange. Ed is the retired CEO of Holy Cross Energy. And in the early 60s, Ed watched as Peter Seibert started working on the excavation of what would become the Vail Ski Resort. All the while, Peter Seibert was assuming that public service would supply the electric power.
We didn't pay too much attention to it because there was not a lot of activity. But then, beginning in late 61 and early 62, there had been a lot of construction. There was some publicity about the ski area that was going to perhaps open in a few years. And our first real serious encounter with this group, because we really didn't know what all was going on up there, except that there was construction going on the mountain and crews were clearing trees to make the ski runs. And nobody had really come to us for anything about power. I think they were using the meters that had been in there for the ranches, for their workers, and things were going on. We didn't have a clue as to really what was going to end up. Particularly in the early days, you know, some of the ski areas used diesel power for their ski lifts. That was a common thing when the ski areas first started. Aspen Highlands, for instance, at Aspen, ran on diesel for years after we were up there. And Whip Jones, who owned Highlands, just wasn't interested in electric power until he finally had to rebuild some of his ski motors. But we really didn't have any idea that we were going to be involved in much of anything until early spring, I guess, maybe April or May of 1962. Pete Seibert, of course, who had the vision of a Vail for quite a few years, Earl Eaton had taken him up there, and they had looked at it in the wintertime, skied it all, and said, this is the place that's going to be famous someday. There's no skiing like there is at Vail. Well, Pete had called Holy Cross, called George, and said, I need to set up a meeting with you. Would you be available? And George had set a time, and the day that Pete came down, he asked me to go into his office. I mean, let's see what Mr. Seibert has got to say. Well, Pete came in and we visited a while, and he says, you know, I've got a real problem because I'm in the middle of construction. We're clearing runs. We're getting ready to set towers. And I've got the gondola ordered from Switzerland. He says, it's going to be built and shipped in a couple of months. And he says, so I thought I better go to Denver and see about getting some power. So he said he'd been over Denver and talked to Public Service Company. Public Service, as I said before, they had power in Minturn, right in town. They had built that line years and years ago, I guess, to serve Minturn. And he logically thought, well, that's where I should go. Well, he got a rude awakening when he talked to Public Service in Denver. They scoffed at his proposals. You know, Pete, you're never going to succeed with a ski area over on the other side on the Western Slope. That's too far away from Denver. And, you know, we can't build you a line to serve that unless, you know, you want to put up the money, because we don't think you're going to be successful. Skiing's not that big a deal, and the money we'd have to put into that line out of Minturn, and we'd have to rebuild some stuff. And he says, bottom line, they said I had to pay for the whole cost. And he says, I don't have any more money. I spent the rest of the balance that I had mostly on the gondola. He says, I know Holy Cross serves those few places up the lower valley. He says, could you give me some help? Well, George and I were a little bit shocked as to what he was proposing. And he says, you know, could you take it to your board and see if maybe they would be willing to build me a line up there so I could get open? You know, he said, our targeted date is December 15th of 62. He says, we've committed to that, that's our opening day. So our next step was to call a board meeting. And you can imagine the response that we got from seven board members who were all ranchers scattered from Woody Creek to Grand Valley and places in between. I don't think skiing was very high on their list of priorities. But they looked at George and they said, you know, we've always done, since the co-op was started, we've pretty much done what you and your people have said that we should be doing. He said, if you think this is a good deal, we don't know anything about skiing, but if you want to do this, maybe you can get a contract that would be suitable to our attorney. And if you want to do it, go ahead. But I could pretty well envision that if this didn't succeed, that probably both George and I would be looking for jobs someplace else. Well, you can imagine George's and my trepidations when we finally got the board to approve it. We weren't completely convinced either, because George had gone to Denver to meet with Mountain States Tell-and-Tell. That's the telephone company in those days, was the old Mountain States Telephone and Telegraph. They had an office in downtown Denver, and George met with one of the vice presidents, I guess, and his vice president said, told George, he says, we really don't know why you're doing this. They have come to us, too, about telephone service. And I guess what you guys are proposing is that we put the telephone lines on your poles. And he says, we can do that as long as you're putting the poles in. We can just put our lines down below. And he says, but George, you're making a big mistake. He says, this will never succeed. It's not going to work. Skiing is not that a good a proposition that we can see here in Denver. So George came back pretty discouraged after that. He said, you know what they told me in Denver? I says, yeah, I can imagine. But we got him to sign a contract, had no minimum on it, just that they were going to buy power from us. And so early June, we said, if we're going to get this done, we got to hire a contractor and get with it. Well, the ski area, the ski lifts was only the first part of it. They were building the gondola and two chairlifts. There were only three really big loads there. But Pete's vision, of course, was much bigger than that. They had to start the village also so that they would have accommodations for all these skiers that were going to come. So that was another challenge. And he says, you know, we don't want any overhead power lines. This is going to be kind of an alpine village. And he says, you got to put everything underground that's going to serve the lodges and the housing. And that made us scratch our heads because we hadn't done much underground, you know, in the early days. Everything was overhead, pure and simple. We had done a little tiny subdivision in, called Calderwood in Aspen. So we knew a little bit about what was happening. In those days, everything was pretty much direct buried and the voltage was not extreme like our other lines were, 7,000 volts, 12,000. And for underground, we had to go to 2,400 volt. And it was all direct buried cable. We said, well, that's what we got to do. I guess that's what we got to do. So we hired an engineering firm to lay this out and got a contractor, a separate contractor from who was doing the overhead to the ski lifts. And they got with it and laid out. They had pretty good layout of what the town was going to look like. So we also started on that. Fortunately, 62 was, for us, it was fortunate because it was a dry year, not very cold. We were able with these two contractors, which were both pretty good. They got the underground in for the few buildings that they were going to have in the beginning into the ski lifts, and everything got finished by December 15th. and on opening day, they had hardly any snow. They opened a couple of runs, and I think skiing was free. And then a few weeks later, I think over in January, it really did start to snow. So things got better, and I'm sure I remember correctly, the lift tickets were $5 a day for the rest of the season. And I know they must have lost a ton of money that first year. But that was the beginning of Vail, and as you look at it now, that valley is wall to wall with big commercial structures. The ski area is developed in one of the biggest in the country, and none of us ever envisioned what was going to be there that afternoon when Pete came into our office and said, "Hey, you know, I need help. I just can't let this thing go under. We've got to get this thing going." And I guess I would say that it was one of the gambles that paid off. I'm just thankful that it wasn't a mistake.
That was Ed Grange, retired CEO of Holy Cross Energy. In 1950, when Ed went to work for Holy Cross, there were 7 employees serving 700 customers in Eagle, Gypsum, and the Roaring Fork Valley. Today, there are 125 employees serving nearly 60,000 people.